I want to talk to you about an ancient, well, we call it a book, but it's not a book, it's just a letter, a compilation of poems. And it's called Lamentations. And now most of us, when we hear the word Lamentations, we think of lamenting, correct, properly, to lament. To lament, to most of us in the English vernacular, tends to mean to cry or to complain even, which is a very good way to frame the word, the meaning of Lamentations, right? In the Hebrew, though, the name of the book, which isn't a book, it's actually just a collection of poems. There are five short poems that are written. And these five poems, in very poetic Hebrew language, which doesn't come through in the translations, it's very artsy. For instance, they use acrostics. They use, in the first poem, they just go through the entire Hebrew alphabet, starting each verse. It goes through the alphabet, things like that, doublets and coupling and all kinds of linguistic techniques. But the word in the Hebrew, the name of the book in Hebrew is Ekah. And Ekah, translated into the English, means how, with a question mark. And in regards to the book of Lamentations, it's talking about catastrophe. It's talking about what has taken place to the people of God, the chosen people, about 2,600 years ago. It's called the Babylonian exile. And this is a major pillar in the Jewish story, this period of exile and the destruction of the first temple. And it's a small, beautifully, artistically done five poems of lamenting and asking how. Have you ever seen something in your life and you're just going, how? And you got to try to figure it out and unpack it. I feel we're like kind of that at that time in this nation. Right? I mean, how many weekends now have I come up here going like, oh my God, you know, I can't believe what just happened. Did you see what just happened? Did you see what just happened? Did the news? I mean, it just seems like every weekend. This morning already, 10 police officers shot in Baton Rouge, okay, in an ambush this morning. Several are dead. Others are in critical condition. We're at a time in this country where there is so much upheaval, and it looks like it's going to get a lot worse before or if it ever gets any better, especially the direction that so many are heading. You know, you flip on the news, and it's just like, wow. You know, somebody takes a truck and runs over a bunch of people and in Nice, France, and kills, you know, 80 people and kids and lamentations. So it's an appropriate thing to look at in our life, and I want to talk a little bit about how to lament. My brother Rob Bell did a nice series on his podcast. Certainly recommend listening to it. I'm going to take a little bit of a different tact in making it a little bit more historic and giving you some of the theology and the history of the Jewish people while this thing is being written 2,600 years ago. The Babylonians invaded and thoroughly raped and pillaged Israel, desecrated its temple, and took its males on a sojourn back to Babylon where they were enslaved. It was a time of terror and siege, and it's described horrifically described in many ways in this account of poems. And when you think of exile, you think of being somewhere where you're not. We're waking up and you're like, as I like to say, you've drifted off the path and you're now somewhere in the deep weeds. You're lost. You're in the woods. You're not where you're supposed to be. And that can be a physical thing. I mean, literally, you can literally as these people were in exile, find yourself like, how do we end up here? But you can also end up in exile spiritually, I would say. And I would say that all of us have experienced times in our life where we've just kind of gone like, wow. Or where we live in a community or a time or in a nation where you just kind of look to the sky and you say, how? How is this happening to me? How is this happening to us? Most of us in this room haven't experienced that. So this book is written, as I like to tell, always the Bible is written from the losers. It's written from the underbelly of the power mechanisms and systems in the world. It's written by poor people to poor people. It's written by oppressed people to oppressed people. Most of us can't understand that. I think of my own parents. As many of you know, my parents' story, my mom and dad, they experienced that kind of upheaval in their life during the Second World War. I mean, they literally experienced kinds of things that most of us in this room have not experienced. I mean, a literal invasion of their town, their community, by an opposing force, being rounded up and thrown into concentration camps, as my parents were. This is the kind of exile, this is the kind of upheaval that many of these stories in the Bible speak to. It's much more like the Syrian experience of Syrian refugees who suddenly are without a nation, without a place to call home, uprooted, running for their lives. And I want to talk about those times in our life a little bit and talk about some movies too, because our culture is a culture of denial. Our culture, when it comes to pain, I've noticed growing up in America, it is one where we tend to insulate from reality. We just do. I don't think it's our natural gut instinct, but it's the way it is. And listen, as a man who's around death as much as I am, I can tell you that's true. And sometimes it's, I've been here for almost 20 years, and I can't tell you how many funerals I've done. I can't tell you, so when I hear about a young black man gunned down that was unarmed, or I hear about a police officer that's gunned down in revenge by somebody else who's deluded. For me, often I think of funerals because I've had to do them so many times. I think about the loss of that dead person, but I also think about the ones that love them, because that's the meetings I've had through the years to sit down with the family members, sifting through pictures, listening to stories, watching people in unspeakable pain, just spinning in that vortex of loss. It's the kind of thing most of us, most of us, especially in a national sense of your whole nation going through something like that. But whether it's the nation or whether it's just you, there's this loss. And in America, we tend to, and you know what, especially in the church. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've done funerals for people, and they think, and it doesn't work. It actually, I don't want to say it never works. It's not what I mean. It's not a judgment. But I've seen so many times where there was just like, well, I'm a Christian, and so there's just an expectation that I should still be jolly, even though my loved one died, because they're in heaven now, and rejoice, rejoice. And I've seen a lot of people just kind of like, not just hiding their emotions, apologizing for them. Like apologizing sometimes. I remember one woman who had just lost her son, and I met her, and it was such a frivolous atmosphere. And I mean, like, everybody was, it was just like really happy. And he was a young man, and he died in a fall. He's a climber. And I met the mom. I've never met her before. And you could just see how she was greeting everybody. She had this, like, she felt like she had to be on, And when I met her, I'm just like, I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer, but I'm just like, I can't even imagine your pain. And, you know, and I would just talk to her at a heart level. And then you could see, you know, her tears would start to well up in her eyes, and she'd go, I'm sorry. And I'm like, you're sorry? Wow. It's like a cultural thing. Now, if you look at some of the Middle Eastern countries, you see a different dealing with it, a different cultural dealing. People are wailing and screaming, and we're kind of like, woo, we're put off by that. But I want to talk about how we deal with grief a little bit in a culture of denial. This is not rocket science. You're going to just go like, oh, yeah, I get it. But let me just read a little bit about this of this poem and also what goes through their heads at this time, okay? The first word is how. Eka. That's the name of the book, How. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she who was once great amongst the nations. She who was a queen amongst the provinces has now become a slave, and bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are upon her cheeks. All her friends have betrayed her and have become her enemies. He's talking about alliances that cut and run. And it just goes on brutally. And it explains, her foes have become her masters, her enemies are at ease. And then it says, the punchline, the Lord has brought her grief because of her many sins. Her children have gone into exile, captive before the foe. Okay, so the theology back then, and still is today for many Orthodox Jews, is Israel was punished for sins. Right? So when they got invaded, whether it was the Assyrians or the Babylonians or then Alexander the Great and the Greeks or the Romans, and many Orthodox rabbis would tell you the Holocaust, 6 million Jews dead is punishment from God for sin. I want you to wrap your head around that for a minute. That's the way they understood what was happening to them during the Babylonian captivity. God to them was a God of good and the God of evil. Not that he was evil in their mind, but he allows evil as a source of punishment to chastise people. So the writer, as many Jews then, just accepted the fact that this thing happened to us because we suck. We're sinners. That's wild. And you know, there's a lot of, in Christianity today, there's still that leaking over of this Janus-faced God. This Janus-faced God who is just ready to rain lightning bolts down on the world. And sometimes capriciously, like a kid who throws bricks off the overpass of a freeway. Whatever. Let's just see who I can wreak havoc on from up on high. It's not a view that I hold of God at all, but it was their view in their time. So in Jesus' day, it's also important that that view was still held by many. And you can begin to understand how Jesus upset the apple cart theologically, because he did not paint a picture of God, his Father, like that at all. It was very, very different. Jesus was speaking of God as a God of grace and a God who of acceptance, a God of unconditional love rather than conditional love. He really upset the apple cart. But people believe that. They believe, like, if you had leprosy, you must have done something, or your parents did. They're called the sins of the father. They just got passed on. If you were crippled, if you were blind, if you were whatever you were afflicted, something, must have done something to bring that on. And Jesus completely disembowels that idea. He says, look, there's none to comfort her. And then the writer says, look, O Lord, on my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. Now, this is the first time that the writer also says, hey, look, God, look to what's happening to us. The enemy has laid hands on all her treasures, speaking of Jerusalem. She saw pagan nations enter her sanctuary. That's actually, in the language, it's very sexualized. It's like the sanctuary has been raped by heathens by entering into her. All her people groan as they search for bread, and they barter their treasures for food to keep themselves alive. Literally, the inflation of this siege has gone through the roof, and they're paying $1 million for a loaf of bread. And then he cries out again, look, O Lord, and consider, for I am despised. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look around and see. Is there any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord brought on me in the day of his fierce anger? He has handed me over to those I cannot withstand. So again, you're seeing that he's like calling out to God, like, God, are you watching what's happening to us here? The Lord is righteous, yet I rebelled against his command. Listen, all you people, look upon my suffering. Like, this is what happens to you if you don't follow God, or if you, you know, this is the big God with a big ruler ready to whack down and crush you. People have heard my groaning, but there's no one to comfort me. And then he goes on to describe God's anger. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion, that's Jerusalem, with a cloud of his anger. He has hurled down the splendor of Israel from heaven to earth. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. Again, this is an anger theology, a wrath theology. The Lord is like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has laid waste his dwelling like a garden. The Lord has made Zion forget her feast, rejected her altar. The elders, he says, sit on the ground in silence, sprinkle dust on their heads, and put on sackcloth, signs of mourning. The young women of Jerusalem have bowed their heads to the ground. We're in the second poem now. My eyes fail from weeping. And then he says, look again, look, O Lord, and consider whom you have treated like this. The thing about Lamentations is this is prayer. This is talking to God. It's talking about God. It's talking to yourself. And here, Lamentations, and you find Lamentations is actually a genre of writing that predates the Bible. You can go to the Mesopotamian religions. There's like the lament of the fall of Ur. There's many laments about catastrophes in writing. This is probably the most sophisticated. If you looked at the genre as a whole, it's really a pretty amazingly sophisticated and artistically done lament. Laments are, as I said earlier, in the English, are complaints too. It's like a complaint. It's like going to God to complain. So even though this theology is, I've done something to deserve this, but it's also like, hey man, but are you taking a look? You know? You think you're going like, is your anger satiated yet? I mean, and think about what a relationship with God would be like where you just thought everything that went wrong in your life was because you deserved it and God was looking at you and angry. Think about that. That's where these people were. And yet he says, look, O Lord, and consider. And then he says, this is descriptive of the siege. Should women eat their offspring, the children they have cared for? Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? The siege was so bad that they were resorting to cannibalism. Okay? So the Jewish God, in this sense, was a God who would punish you by making you eat your own kids. It's pretty severe. Can you imagine being in a religion where you're like, oh my God, we're eating each other. We really must have screwed up the program. Oh man. Dude, this is rad. Yet, he says in the third poem, This I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. In the midst of this collapse, here's the hope. Check it out. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those who hope in him, to those who seek him and wait eagerly for the salvation of the Lord. Wow. Okay, so in despite all that, this person describes God as loving. Yes, he drinks too much sometimes and comes home angry. He kicks the dog, slaps the kids around because we haven't done our chores. He hits the wife. But when he sobers up, he's a pretty good guy. This is this religion that these people are living in back in those days. When he talks to the fact that God's mercies are new every morning in the Jewish belief then and in many today, still, and certainly a good segment in Jesus' day, as many of you know if you've been here for a while, when the writer wrote this, and for that fact the entire Old Testament, there was no concept of eternal life. Okay? That did not exist for the Jews. And when the Old Testament is read today by Christians, that's really imposing a view that didn't exist. So if you look at the Talmudic writings about life and death, when you died, you died. You ceased to exist. You were gone. He went to the grave, Sheol. And in this case, writers of the Hebrew writers would also consider going to sleep at night as a slice of death. That's how they viewed it. And every morning that you wake up, the Jewish writers and commentaries would say, is like a resurrection. You were asleep, and now you're alive again. So every day that you wake up, in the Jewish sense, they have a prayer for that, as a matter of fact, a very beautiful prayer that's the morning prayer for the observant Jews, saying, like, oh, you've raised me from the dead. I'm alive for this day. I give thanks for this day to have life, that kind of thing, because it could end tomorrow. What was thought to be eternal in the minds of the Jews was the community, Israel. So Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the patriarchs, this is a lineage. So there's an eternal lineage that's going on that they believe will someday find, as Isaiah describes it, a new world, a world that'll be free of corruption. Where, as Isaiah's words is, if you live only to be 100 years old, you died like a baby, because life will be so extended there. The views of eternal life didn't come much later till the invasion by Alexander the Great and the introduction of the Greek philosophers, most notably Plato, who developed the concept of the eternal soul, and that was then adopted by the Jews. So, going back, I'm just going to read a few more stanzas here so we get the gist and then leave you with a few thoughts. He says, here's the hope. For men are not cast off by the Lord forever. Though he brings grief, he will show compassion. So great is his unfailing love. And now he goes into a theodicy, which is he begins to try to explain to people, because honestly, you could maybe listen to this and go like, God, your God seems really cruel. Well, yeah, but he's also loving. And then he says, for he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men, to crush underfoot all the prisoners of a land, to deny a man his rights before the Most High, to deprive a man of justice. Would not the Lord see such things? Now he's actually starting to argue with himself. Like, God is good? Well, if you're good, God, then why aren't you doing something? Because this seems like it's out of control. This is like, you can imagine the kind of insanity that a person with this kind of theology would have to live with. Can you imagine that? I mean, up, down, all around, God is, you know, God is making me eat my kids, but God is good. Yeah. You know, and I see Christians do that today. They do. They play with that same kind of jacked up theology because they want to attribute everything to God. And that's not right or fair. You know, I had someone tell me recently, this week, like, you know, message me and just like, I have this affliction and I have prayed to God endlessly. I have spent time with God and I get nothing. And I feel like God is sitting in a chair. That was such a powerful description. Just watching me and doing nothing. Part of that framework is because there's a theology of putting God on strings and levers, right? Especially in Christianity now. Oh, you know. And we do that. We don't even realize we do it. I do it too. I'm not talking down to you. I mean, every time I say that, like, I'm like, oh, that was such a blessing. I just want to turn around, get out of myself, get behind me, and kick me in the ass. Like, because if you think about it, it's such a jacked up, oh, well, the Lord blessed me today. What? Or, you know, I mean, if you really think about that, oh, I got a job. The Lord heard my prayers. And somebody else is going like, you know, what is going on? It can make a person crazy. And it does a lot of people, especially in Christianity. And I know, I mean, if you've been here for a while, you know my whole, my agnosticism about prayer. It's changed. And that doesn't mean if you come to me and you say, Paul, pray that, you know, God will take my cancer away, that I don't hear what you're saying. The truth is, I don't know if God's going to take your cancer away or not, because I really don't think God does those things. Sorry. I don't. I just don't. I don't believe that. I used to. I don't anymore. That doesn't mean I don't wish it at times. I do. But all I'm saying is I'm actually going to pray for, you know, things that I think God can do. Give you comfort. Give you peace. Give you strength. Give you courage. Give you wisdom. Give you community. Those are things I think God can really deliver on in community. And yet it's so much not God doing it. It's God's spirit and work and our obedience to him in that sense in doing it. How does, and that's what I told this person. I'm like, sorry, buddy, I just don't believe God works that way. And I know a lot of friends have told you that. If you just pray a little longer, if you just pray harder, if you just believe, if you just have faith, if you just trust, then you're going to get your breakthrough. And this person says, and every time I do it, all I get is the same thing repeated over and over and over again with my affliction. Over and over and over again. I'm like, I'm really sorry you're afflicted. And I don't think God can do anything about that. But I do believe he can do something about you. Because God doesn't change circumstances so much as he changes people. And when people change, guess what? Circumstances start changing. When people change, bodies stop dropping in the street. When people change, we treat each other with respect like human beings. Now that's a real miracle in my eyes. And that's where I see the power of God working and living and breathing. So, when I look at this book of Lamentations and I think about pain, and it ends on a really depressing note. He questions God and lament and prayer. You know what? Prayer is just being honest with God, and you can be. One of my favorite scenes of prayer in my life is a man who was an atheist in a movie. And you know I'm a movie buff. It's Forrest Gump, right? Forrest Gump, like one of the greatest movies ever made. 13 Academy Award nominations, and it won the Big Six. And if you've seen it, you remember Forrest. He ends up in Vietnam, and he befriends a guy, a lieutenant, Lieutenant Dan, who comes from a legacy of warriors who have died in the battlefield, but Forrest saves Lieutenant Dan. He saves his life. And now they're back in the hospital, and he's lost both his legs. And he is bitter because he was a warrior. And he's like, you stole my legacy. I was supposed to die on the battlefield. And he just becomes this bitter, angry, traumatically damaged human being with no legs who's just shaking a fist at the world, doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in anything. And yet this weird relationship continues to bump into each other. And then they end up on a shrimping boat together. And Lieutenant Dan is like his first mate in his wheelchair. And they end out in a storm. And their hopes and their dreams of making it in the fishing industry were threatened by this storm. And Lieutenant Dan has had it. Like, he's had it with all the crap that has been thrown his way. And he doesn't believe in God, but he's going to talk to God. And he crawls with no legs up to the top of the crow's nest. And in the midst of the lightning and the storm and the thunder and the rain pouring down, he starts having it out with God. I love it. He's like, you call this a storm? This is the best you can do? Blow, bitch, blow. You know, he's just like in God's face, like, come on. I've seen worse than you, you pussy. Give it all you got. I'm not, you know, and they have it out. And then the storm ends, and the next day the sun rises and there's calm seas, and Forrest sees something in him now. Lieutenant Dan suddenly is at peace. It's like he had it out with God. And it's just this beautiful scene. And he doesn't actually say it, but he does. He just says, Forrest, and Forrest says, yeah. He goes, I never told you. And what he's going to say is, I never told you thank you for saving me. But that's as much as he could get out. He goes, I never told you. And he just smiles, and he dips into the water, and he goes for a swim without his legs. And it's just tranquility. Sometimes lamenting means complaining bitterly. And that's really what I want to get to as I close this stuff. We don't know how to grieve in this country. And sometimes we're grieving and we don't even know it. Because we just suppress it. And we have so much to grieve about and so many different ways. You know, you see, like, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Queen. It's really a great movie. Won a bunch of Academy Awards. So you know I'm a movie buff, right? But it's about the Queen of England during the Princess Diana tragedy. And in this movie, they're recreating, you know, Princess Diana dies suddenly in France, and the nation's in shock, and they don't know what to do, and they're all waiting for the Queen to say something to bring some sort of togetherness, calm, and she refuses to speak. Actually, the family is not even thinking about it that much. They're in their own quandary, but she really wasn't so crazy about Princess Diana and her antics. And they just keep waiting, and Tony Blair keeps going like, you've got to do something. And then he says, they're putting flowers out front of the palace. And then overnight, this thing turns into a mountain of flowers and candles and wreaths. People are pouring in from everywhere in England, coming to the palace. And, you know, that's sometimes what happens with grief. That sometimes is like why you see people get so moved and so enthralled by the loss of a celebrity. And you wonder, like, well, what's up? You know, whatever, whoever it is. But you all of a sudden your heart, because for a lot of people, they weren't able to grieve stuff, but here's something they can grieve and others are doing it. So gosh dang it, I'm going to go do that because somehow this feels right. This feels good. And you may go, like, oh, I can't believe they're like all jacked up about a celebrity. No, it's much, much more than that. It's about the deep threads of pain and unresolved grief that all of us in this room carry. And the first thing we can do to grieve properly is, and I know this sounds like, oh, that's easy. It's just to be honest with it. It's okay. Now, that's difficult because sometimes, honestly, you're going to be honest about your grief. And there's going to be a lot of people around you that are like, woo, because we're not used to that. We don't want to hear about that. You know, ooh. You know, I know people who have been like grieving and then they become like a leper. Don't want to hang around that person. Kind of a bummer. Woo. And they want to distance themselves and they want to create, because we're not used to that. But we need to be honest. We need to name it. We need to pull it out. Our health, our mental, spiritual, physical health is bound up in that being able to drag it out into the open and deal with it. It's like lancing an infection. It can be ugly. God, my one friend posted this, I got to tell you this, on Facebook. Like, dude, gnarliest infection ever, right? So like on a back or something. So, of course, I hit it and I got a look, you know, and it just looks like a big lump. And the doctor lances it and starts to squeeze it. And I'm telling you, what came out of there? And I'm telling you, the thing that it was, it just went on and on and on. I'm talking like gallon after gallon after gallon of, looked like soft serve, just coming out, just squeezing it up. You know, and yet, to actually do something about the infection, you got to lance it. You got to open it up. You got to squeeze all that crap out. And sometimes that's the way it is with grieving. We got to just open it up. We got to squeeze it all out. And until that's done, we're never resolved in our grief. The movie Spotlight. One more movie. Spotlight. Again, Academy Award. It's about the Archdiocese of Boston, where they had serial child-abusing priests. Systemic. Ongoing. And they're just shuffling these guys. They're not dealing with it. And the story breaks through one person who speaks, and the reporter uncovers this thing, and what he finds is just like, you know, picking up a rock and just finding roaches just running everywhere. He's just like appalled at the systemic abuse that was going on in there. And through that one person that came forward, you know, they put like a hotline in their article. If you've been abused, call 1-800-HERE. In the morning, they had like 400 messages of people who had been abused. People who then came and began to lance the infection of what they carried inside of them. The pain, the horror, the violation. Man, sometimes to grieve, we just got to be honest. We got to bring it out and we've got to lance it. And that's what the community of faith is so amazing. The genius of Jesus in calling us together, to be together, is that we can do these things together. If there's one moment that makes me feel significant in my work through the countless 29 years that I've been doing this, it's that moment when I sit with somebody who has come to me in confidentiality and opens up and lances their wound, and I can see in their face they can't believe I'm not running out the door. They can't believe that I'm not going like, ooh, God, really? You did what? Or that happened to you? You know, just where they can just be open and begin the process of cleaning it out and begin the process of healing. So, honesty and a community that you can be honest in. I hope that this is a place where we can carry each other's burdens, where you can come to one or another or all of us in your grief, in your hurt. You can be honest and open with it. You can let it all out and not be judged. Because sometimes when we let it out, it doesn't come out in the best ways. And a lot of people who are frustrated and angry and hurt and not heard don't let it out in the best ways. We're seeing that right now being played out. We're seeing that. We're seeing places in America where people are like, nobody's listening to us. Nobody's seeing what we're seeing. And you know in your own home, that happens, what happens? You begin to ratchet it up, right? You begin to have that argument with your spouse and not being heard and not being heard, or with your kids, and the next thing you know, you're like going to DEFCON 2. I'm throwing out the first F-bomb, you know? You spike the language because you want to be heard. And that happens because of that. You want to be heard. So you go stand out and you stop the traffic on the 405 because you want to be heard. I hate that because I hate traffic. I don't like to sit in traffic. I do want to hear you, but I don't want you stopping the traffic. But if you don't understand what that means, then you actually miss the whole flyby. They're trying to say, I'm being heard. People are killing each other now because they want to be heard. It doesn't make it right. It's wrong. It's horrific. Counterproductive. It's creating more infection, more disease, more pain. But the cure is at the same time also being able to listen and hear and comfort and empathize and heal. Grace, peace, lamenting prayers, honesty, if necessary, a fist at the heavens on your path to healing. Amen.